In April of 1997, Judy Smith disappeared from Philadelphia. On a trip with her husband, Jeffrey, to a legal convention, Judy planned to see the sights while Jeffrey worked throughout the day. The nights were meant for the couple to catch up and spend time together, but Judy would vanish before that could happen. When Jeffrey returned to their room to meet Judy before attending a cocktail party, she was nowhere to be found. After filing a missing persons report, Jeffrey searched everywhere, but no one seemed to have any answers. Several witnesses reported seeing Judy, but no one knew her current whereabouts. While investigators began looking at Jeffrey as a suspect, he hired private investigators to search for his missing wife. 5 months later, in September of 1997, 600 miles to the south in the mountains of western North Carolina, the Buncombe County Sheriff's Office recovered unidentified skeletal remains. These remains would later be identified as those of Judy Smith, though learning her identity only opened up more questions for which there were no answers. What brought Judy to North Carolina? Why hadn't she told anyone about her plans to go south? And who did she meet along the way who may hold the answer as to how and why she was murdered? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 93, The Mysterious Murder of Judy Smith. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the mysterious murder of Judy Smith. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focusing on a different unsolved case each week. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at @TraceEvPod, on Instagram at @TraceEvidencePodcast, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. As a final note, Trace Evidence is a complete one-man operation, so if you'd like to help support the podcast, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can gain rewards such as stickers, pins, and other surprises. If Patreon isn't your thing, but you still want to pitch in, there is a PayPal donation button on the website. Today we examine a case that involves a disappearance followed by the recovery of human remains some 600 miles from the last place that the victim had been seen. This is episode 93, The Mysterious Murder of Judy Smith. Pisgah National Forest sits in the Appalachian Mountains of western North Carolina and encompasses over 510,000 acres. Sitting approximately 11 miles south of Asheville, the forest is a popular spot for hikers of all skill levels, from those who look to casually walk the trails to those who seek to ascend mile-high peaks jutting out from the densely forested mountainside. Looking Glass Falls, as well as Sliding Rock, are popular locations that can be easily accessed as U.S. Route 276 passes through the forest, making it a simple trip to drive in, park, and make a short trek to the locations. During the summer, Sliding Rock is typically swarmed by adults and children alike who slide down the mountainside, smoothed out by years of water flow, finding themselves deposited into a deep pool of clear, cool water. However, on September 7, 1997, Pisgah National Forest became the location of a horrifying discovery made by a father and son out on a hunting expedition. The Stony Fork picnic area sits near Chestnut Creek, McKinney Creek, and Stony Fork. At approximately 4 p.m., the father and son arrived in the area where they quickly noted the appearance of bones, scattered over an area 300 feet in diameter. At the center of the area, the two men discovered the remnants of a human skeleton and immediately fled the area to contact authorities and report their findings. The Buncombe County Sheriff's Office was the responding agency, and when they arrived at the scene, they were shocked by what had been found. The skeleton at the center of the area had been wrapped in a blue blanket before being placed in a shallow grave. The bones around the area, investigators reasoned, had been spread by animals in the forest over a short period of time. According to reports of the time, the bones, when recovered, showed that the victim had been dressed in hiking gear at the time, and during the search, several personal effects were found nearby. Whoever had dug the shallow grave had also fanned out, digging several smaller holes in the area into which specific items were concealed. From one, police retrieved a blue backpack. In another, a pair of sunglasses. The blue backpack contained warmer winter-style clothing and $80. Another hole, when discovered, had a shirt tucked into it. That shirt had $87 in the pocket. A diamond wedding ring still rested on one of the victim's fingers, and while cash was found at the scene, no wallet was recovered, which also meant no identification had been found either. While the cause of death could not be determined at the scene, investigators noted cuts in the victim's bra, suggesting the possibility of stabbing. While the discovery was horrifying to both investigators and residents alike, things like this don't typically happen in the area, it also brought back memories of another crime. Just 2 years earlier, the body of a woman, Karen Stiles, had been recovered not far from this particular location. In that instance, the victim had been bound to a tree by duct tape, sexually assaulted, and murdered by a gunshot. Now, a new body had been found, and police were wondering if there could possibly be a connection between the two. Unfortunately, until they could determine the identity of the victim, it would be difficult to begin piecing together the hows and whys of what brought her into this remote area. Considering the challenge of the countryside and the difficulty even skilled hikers had in reaching it, investigators speculated that the victim had likely been alive at the scene and had gotten there of her own efforts. They thought it would have been too difficult for someone to have killed her elsewhere and then carried her remains up the mountain. Considering the money and ring which had been left behind, detectives fairly quickly ruled out robbery as a possible motive. After examining the scene thoroughly and gathering up all evidence which could be found, the body was delivered to the state medical examiner's office in Chapel Hill, where testing would reveal several interesting details. Cutting marks were noted on the victim's ribs, which seemed to align with tears and cuts in her bra, and it was quickly ruled that the death came as a result of homicide. The medical examiner stated that the victim was likely somewhere between her early 40s and mid-50s at the time of her death, and had likely been left in the shallow grave within the past year or year and a half. Further examination showed that the victim had a great deal of dental work done and that she suffered from severe arthritis in her left knee. It would be these two details revealed to the public that would aid in a quick identification. However, while the discovery of the victim's name would typically result in producing some answers, in this case, it would only raise more questions. Angel Medical Center is a community hospital located in the city of Franklin in Macon County, North Carolina, approximately 70 miles to the west of Asheville. It was here that Dr. Parker Davis heard the news about the discovery of the unidentified woman, and it reminded him of a missing persons case he'd read about through a fax the hospital had received. What mostly captured Dr. Davis's attention was the notation about the victim and the missing woman both suffering from severe arthritis. In response to hearing about the discovery, Dr. Davis took the news article he was reading and faxed it over to the Philadelphia police, who had been searching for a woman named Judy Smith. According to the Philadelphia City paper, Detective James Sweeney received the fax and immediately reached out to Judy Smith's husband, Jeffrey, who had reported his wife missing some 5 months earlier in April. With the news article noting the dental work of the unknown victim, Detective Sweeney requested Judy's dental records, and it was through these records that it would be confirmed that the woman who had been found in Pisgah Forest was in fact Judy Smith. But now the question became, how did Judy get from Philadelphia to Pisgah Forest, some 600 miles away? The details surrounding her initial disappearance were baffling to begin with, but this discovery made the entire case even more mysterious. Judy Smith was born Judith Eldridge on December 15, 1946 in Hyannis, Massachusetts. Judy had been married three times. Her first husband had fled the country in an attempt to escape the Vietnam War draft. Judy married again, this time to Charles Bradford, with whom she would have a son and a daughter. When this marriage ended, Judy was left as a single mother raising two children with nothing more than a high school diploma, but Judy was never one to step back from a challenge. The young mother managed to work, support her children, and make her way through nursing school, becoming a home care nurse in the Boston area. It would be through her career as a nurse that Judy would ultimately meet, fall in love with, and marry Jeffrey Smith. Smith would later say that he'd been very impressed by the level of care Judy had provided his father, and he found Judy very easy to talk to. According to the blog Strange Company, Smith was a lawyer and the son of one of Judy's patients who was recovering from throat surgery, and the couple would embark on a 10-year relationship that ultimately culminated in their marriage in 1996, which would unite Judy's two children with Jeffrey's one. According to friends and family, Judy and Jeffrey had an extremely happy marriage. They got along well, enjoyed one another's company, and for the most part, no one felt there were any issues between the two, at least not those outside the normal bounds of disputes that occur between all married couples. The two lived in the New England area where Jeffrey worked as a lawyer, representing the Northeast Pharmaceutical Conference. Jeffrey's work would sometimes require travel. And in April of 1997, some 8 months after their marriage, he was set to attend a conference in Philadelphia from the 9th to the 11th. Judy decided to go along on the trip with Jeffrey, after which the two made plans to visit friends in New Jersey before making their way home. Unfortunately, Judy would not return home with Jeffrey, and her disappearance would become a complicated mystery that no one could explain. The couple arrived at the airport for their trip to Philadelphia on the morning of Wednesday, April 9th. Upon arriving at the airport, they began the check-in process when Judy realized that she'd forgotten her license at home. Not wanting Jeffrey to be late for his conference, the two agreed that Judy would return home to retrieve her license and then take a later flight while Jeffrey himself would take the one they'd originally booked. They had a room booked for a week at the DoubleTree Hotel, and so, several hours after arriving himself, Jeffrey was met in the lobby by Judy, who had caught the later flight and finally made it to Philadelphia. Since Jeffrey was going to be busy with the conference throughout the day, Judy planned to hit many of the tourist hotspots in Philadelphia. According to Jeffrey, they planned to spend their days apart, but to get together in the evenings and catch up. Judy was excited to see the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall, and Jeffrey was looking forward to hearing her accounts of the landmarks. The next morning, Jeffrey awoke early to get ready for a day of conferencing. Not wanting to wake Judy, who appeared to be worn out from the trip, he headed down to the hotel lobby to grab something to eat from the complimentary breakfast. Jeffrey would later tell investigators that he returned to their room at approximately 9 a.m., at which time he could hear Judy taking a shower. Jeffrey stated that he told Judy to grab some breakfast and enjoy her day, and that he'd catch up with her that night at a cocktail party. Jeffrey gathered his work for the day and exited the room, never knowing that this would be the last conversation he'd ever have with his wife. While Jeffrey imagined an evening together, a quiet dinner, some laughs, and the cocktail party, instead, he'd be faced with his wife's mysterious disappearance. Jeffrey returned to the couple's room at approximately 5:30 p.m., but Judy wasn't there. They had discussed the cocktail party that morning, which was set to take place at 6 p.m., In an interview with the Philadelphia City paper, Jeffrey later stated, quote, "I was a little concerned, but I thought maybe we had mixed signals and that she thought she was supposed to proceed to the cocktail party. So I went down to the room where the cocktail party was, and I kind of floated back and forth between the room where the cocktail party was and our room for the next half or three quarters of an hour." End quote. Judy, though, never arrived at the party. And every time Jeffrey returned to their room, he found it as empty and quiet as it had been the previous time he visited. At approximately 6:15, Jeffrey notified the front desk that he couldn't find his wife. After discussing her plans for the day, an employee at the hotel began calling around to local hospitals, wondering if perhaps Judy had been involved in an accident, but there were no patients or reports that matched Judy. Finally reaching his breaking point, Jeffrey hailed a cab and directed the man to follow the route led by a local tourist bus tour which Judy had been set to ride on. Jeffrey sat in the cab as they traversed the streets of Philadelphia, looking for any signs of Judy or where she may have gone, but the longer the trip progressed, the less the situation seemed to make sense. At the conclusion of the drive, Jeffrey returned to the hotel, making several phone calls back up to Boston, where he spoke with Judy's children, neither of which had received any calls or messages from their mother. Finally, with no other options and unsure of what to do, Jeffrey arrived at the Philadelphia Police Department where he attempted to file a missing persons report, but was told he had to wait until 24 hours had passed. Frustrated and lost, Jeffrey returned to the hotel for a sleepless night. Early in the morning, Jeffrey planned to return to the police department, but he already felt hopeless at the way he'd been treated the previous day. Jeffrey felt the police were not going to take his missing persons report seriously, and so, knowing that prominent Philadelphia politicians were also attending his conference, he took the time to speak to two men. One, a member of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, and the other, the mayor of Philadelphia. Jeffrey would later report that these two conversations resulted in a complete about-face by the Philadelphia Police Department, who were not only attentive and supportive when taking his missing persons report, but who had also been sitting and waiting for his arrival that morning. Unfortunately, though, this would not be the end of what he believed to be disinterest and mistreatment from the police. One theory which emerged early from at least one Philadelphia detective was that Judy had suffered from a midlife crisis which resulted in her leaving Philadelphia of her own volition, but to an unknown destination. No one accepted that theory, though. Jeffrey argued his wife would never just up and leave, and her children had never gone this long without hearing from their mother. The other theory, and one which was entertained by some as a little more probable, was that Jeffrey himself may have been responsible for the disappearance of his wife. Captain John McGinnis of the Philadelphia Police told the city paper, quote, "We are trying to keep a very open mind on what occurred here. When you look at statistics, 85-90% of females are killed by someone very close to them, a family member, spouse, boyfriend. Statistically, we have to look at Jeffrey Smith as a suspect until it's proven that he is not a suspect." End quote. Judy's daughter, Amy, was brought in for an interview, and Jeffrey was asked not to be present, to which he agreed. While investigators hoped to dig up information that could paint Jeffrey into a corner, they got quite the opposite. Jeffrey was depicted as a kind, good man who loved his wife and didn't even lie on his taxes. The idea that he could have ever committed a crime that resulted in the disappearance of his wife simply wasn't an area that anyone who knew him believed needed to be investigated. It simply wasn't possible. Investigators felt different, and a bitter dispute would break out between the police and Jeffrey Smith. Much of this revolved around a polygraph which Jeffrey was asked to take. According to Jeffrey, he agreed to take the test under the conditions that it be administered directly by the FBI, and that when he passed it, the Philadelphia police request the assistance of the FBI in the investigation. The Philadelphia police, however, argued that Jeffrey outright refused to take a polygraph. Captain McGinnis argued that Jeffrey had been told that the FBI would not agree to join the search, and so requesting their involvement was seen as a way to accept the polygraph, but to not have to actually take it. Police Commissioner Richard Zappile told a reporter, quote, "He refused. Certain conditions were met, but as far as I'm concerned, he refused," end quote. McGinnis would add to that conversation, quote, "We asked him, he said no. That's a refusal no matter how you word it. He's a lawyer, I'm sure he's very good with words, but the bottom line is he was asked to take one and he didn't take one," end quote. The FBI later commented that while they had not been asked to participate, they would have declined, as at the time, no evidence existed to show anything connecting Judy's disappearance to crossing state lines, nor were there any details which would give the federal agency any kind of jurisdiction. Police were now beginning to question whether or not Judy had ever even arrived in Philadelphia, wondering if it was possible that something may have happened to her before the trip. A hotel employee reported seeing Judy, and later another conference attendee informed police that he'd encountered Judy in the hotel lobby, but investigators still had their questions. When the initial report had been filed, a female detective had searched the hotel room the couple shared and noted that it was odd that Judy had vanished without changing her clothes. The only clothing missing from her luggage was the clothing that she had flown to Philadelphia in, meaning that she'd have put on the same clothing the next morning when she went out to see the sights. Judy's daughter later stated that this was not out of the ordinary for Judy when she was traveling. While investigators took a hard look at Jeffrey, the Philadelphia media ran with the story, and within hours of the initial report, local news stations were discussing the mysterious disappearance. This coverage, in conjunction with flyers and newspaper reports, resulted in several individuals contacting authorities to report sightings of the missing nurse. An employee from the Society Hill Hotel reported a woman appeared to be suffering from psychological issues and resembled Judy Smith had stayed at the hotel between April 13th and 15th. The woman was reported to have spoken in tongues, argued out loud with people who weren't there, and when asked about payment, argued that the emperor would be sending her money through Western Union. Another employee of a different hotel, the Best Western, reported a woman matching Judy's description had come in to use the phone the day she vanished at approximately 4:30 p.m. He described the woman as larger in size with blonde hair, thick makeup, and wearing glasses with tape on them. This woman matched the description given by those of employees at the Society Hill Hotel, but when she returned later, police were able to speak with the woman and confirmed that it was not Judy Smith. After this particular person was ruled out, other sightings began coming in. One man reported seeing a woman fitting Judy's description sitting outside of a grocery store at approximately 6 a.m. the morning after her disappearance. A homeless man identified a photo of Judy, claiming to have seen her sleeping on a bench on April 14th. Sightings of Judy placed her all over the area, once in a Greyhound bus station, later at a department store in New Jersey. The department store sightings seem more reliable, as witnesses reported that the woman wore a red backpack, which Judy took everywhere with her. While multiple sightings were reported, no one could ever confirm whether or not the woman seen was in fact Judy Smith, and if it was, where was she going and why hadn't she contacted any of her family? As time began passing, Jeffrey was growing desperate. Feeling that the Philadelphia police were looking more at him than anything else, he hired two private investigators to search for Judy. The private investigators spoke to many of those who had called in sightings of Judy, though for the most part, they didn't believe the woman witnesses had seen was Judy. Just 1 month before Judy's remains would be recovered in Pisgah Forest, a Philadelphia detective told a reporter that they no longer believed she could be in the city, as far too many people had been searching for her and nothing had been found. He qualified that statement by adding, "if Judy was ever actually in Philadelphia." Then, in September of 1997, conversations between the Buncombe County Sheriff's Office and the Philadelphia Police Department, along with Judy's dental records, confirmed the identity of the victim found in Pisgah Forest. Suddenly, there were a lot more questions than answers. How did Judy find herself some 600 miles away from where she had last been seen? What brought her into the mountains of Western North Carolina? And who could have been the person responsible for her murder? One detail which seemed apparent, whoever had committed this crime was not Jeffrey Smith. If nothing else, the horrible discovery had, in part, cleared his name. Jeffrey was described as morbidly obese, and it was argued by investigators that he could not have ascended into the area where Judy's remains had been found. Not to mention, there were witnesses placing him in Philadelphia during the time that Judy was missing. Trying to determine how Judy arrived in the Asheville area proved quite difficult. There were no records of her using any form of mass transportation, and no suggestions that she had rented a vehicle. Some have gone on to believe Judy may have caught a ride with someone, though whether or not this was a stranger or someone she knew has never been determined. What's truly bizarre is that there's no indication that Judy, at any point in her life, ever mentioned Western North Carolina, Pisgah Forest, or Asheville as destinations for a trip. As far as her family was concerned, she had no knowledge of the area and no connections to anyone living within hundreds of miles of where she was ultimately found. There were also other questions raised, but perhaps most notably was, why was a blue backpack found at the location where Judy had been recovered, but not her red backpack that she took everywhere? Its location remains unknown today. When Jeffrey was brought to see Judy, he was unable to identify any of the clothing she was wearing as belonging to her, which led authorities to believe that the clothes had either been provided to her or she had purchased them at some point in time. The sunglasses and backpack found at the location could not be identified as belonging to Judy either. Buncombe County investigators began canvassing Asheville and surrounding areas, looking for anyone who may have seen Judy in the days before her murder, and they were able to locate a few witnesses who did report that they had seen and even interacted with Judy. Joanne Stucker, who worked at a retail store, reported seeing and speaking with Judy. In an interview with Unsolved Mysteries, Stucker stated, quote, "She seemed very alert to me. She was very pleasant. I didn't see anything about her that would indicate that she wasn't right in any way. She told me her husband was an attorney and they were from Boston, and that they had been in Pennsylvania and he was at a convention and she decided to come down here," end quote. A family friend, Carolyn Dickey, contended that Judy may have gone to the area to take a break, so to speak, from her marriage. While everyone had said things between Judy and Jeffrey were going well, Dickey claimed things weren't as happy as they had been presented. She later stated, quote, "At the time this happened, Jeff and Judy's marriage was very tenuous. I believe that something did happen that triggered her to want to have some time away from Jeff," end quote. Two witnesses in the Asheville area reported seeing Judy as well, but in their accounts, she was behind the wheel of what has been described as a gray sedan. One witness, the owner of a campground not far from Stony Fork, claimed to have seen Judy driving up in a vehicle, which he described as being loaded with boxes and bags. He claimed Judy asked if she could spend the night there in her car, but when she was told no, she simply drove away. A store owner not far from the campground had a similar experience, seeing Judy in the gray sedan, though she claimed Judy entered the store, at which time she purchased $30 worth of food and a toy truck. While these theories cannot be fully verified, local investigators do believe the witnesses to be credible. Of course, that raises more questions. Who was the toy truck for, and where did the gray sedan come from? While Judy's family struggled to accept the reality of her loss, investigators continued trying to determine what had happened. They had a lot of information and pieces of evidence, but almost nothing to answer the questions they were asking. Ultimately, very little has been determined about Judy's case outside of speculation, rumors, and theory. One name which has been brought up a lot was that of Gary Michael Hilton. Hilton, sometimes known as the National Forest Serial Killer, murdered and decapitated four people between North Carolina, Georgia, and Florida from 2005 to 2008. In October of 2007, 10 years after the recovery of Judy's remains, Hilton came upon an elderly couple, John and Irene Bryant, in Pisgah Forest. Hilton murdered Irene via blunt force trauma, leaving her not far from where the couple had parked their car. He then abducted John, forcing him to hand over his ATM card and PIN number. John was killed by a gunshot and left in the Nantahala National Forest. Hilton would go on to receive a life sentence in Georgia, a death sentence in Florida, and four life sentences in North Carolina. While Hilton was a killer who certainly utilized National Forest's dumping grounds, no evidence has ever been found to link him to the murder of Judy Smith, though for many, he's considered a likely suspect. Other names batted around were those of Lewis Kyle Wilson, who had been arrested for kidnapping and assaulting a sex worker in 2009. According to a report from the Mountain Express, Wilson picked up the sex worker, knocked her out, and then took her home where he forced her to perform oral sex and then stabbed her in the head, though she did survive and escaped. Wilson was also named as a person of interest in the murder of Kelly Lane Smith. Smith had been abducted, raped, and dismembered, with her body parts being left in two separate locations, both of which were less than a mile from Wilson's home, though he has never been officially charged with that crime. On May 12th of 2016, a 64-year-old woman was abducted, sexually assaulted, and left tied to a tree in the Craggy Gardens area of the Blue Ridge Parkway. Her assailant has never been captured, but a composite sketch is available and depicts a disheveled man in his 50s with graying hair and unkempt facial hair. How long this particular suspect had been in the area and where he went afterward remains a mystery, but the fact of the matter remains that the dense national forests of western North Carolina have been the locations of several unsolved crimes in addition to the murder of Judy Smith. As I had previously mentioned, Karen Stiles, a 22-year-old, disappeared on Halloween of 1994 after going jogging in Pisgah National Forest. Her remains were found less than a month later on November 25th. The young woman had been raped, duct-taped to a tree, and shot once in the head with a .22 caliber rifle. Police were able to track down her killer, Richard Allen Jackson, by tracing the weapon he had used to commit the crime. Jackson admitted to the crime and was given the death penalty, though his admission was later overruled by the Supreme Court of North Carolina, who deemed that his confession had been obtained illegally. Ultimately, Jackson was given a new trial where he instead pled guilty to second-degree murder, first-degree rape, and second-degree kidnapping, for which he received a sentence of 25 to 30 years in prison. This devastated the Stiles family, who now had to live the rest of their lives without Karen, while her killer can possibly exit prison after serving only 20 years. While this case was solved, whether or not to anyone's satisfaction, the murder of Judy Smith remains a giant question mark that mars the face of Western North Carolina law enforcement. In terms of evidence, new developments, anything that might bring us closer to knowing the truth behind Judy's final days, little, if anything, has been found. How Judy arrived in Western North Carolina is still a mystery, and what brought her to the remote mountain location has never been determined. Whether or not Judy traveled alone, knew someone in the area, or perhaps met someone in the area or along the way, is almost anyone's guess. The only information investigators believe they possess about the person who murdered Judy Smith was that the sunglasses and the blue backpack found buried at the scene are believed to have belonged to that killer. It's been 22 years since Judy Smith was murdered and buried in the Pisgah National Forest. Over those years, little has been discovered, and the theories remain quite similar to what they were early on in the investigation. The first theory, despite police stating otherwise, argues that Judy Smith may have been murdered by her husband Jeffrey, either directly or via the hiring of a hitman. Police don't believe Jeffrey was involved, but there are still those who argue that he could have committed this crime. The second theory connects known killers who have practiced in the Western North Carolina region, including Gary Michael Hilton and Lewis Kyle Wilson, who were known to leave the remains of their victims in national park areas and to have operated in the area itself. The third and final theory is that Judy Smith was murdered by someone she either planned to see in Western North Carolina, or perhaps that she met along her journey. There are those who believe Judy planned to abscond to the mountains for a break from her marriage and perhaps everyday life, and that during this journey to figure things out, she may have come upon her killer. Others believe Judy may have known her killer and specifically visited the area to see him, not knowing what would happen. On January 25, 2005, some 8 years after the murder of Judy Smith, her husband Jeffrey passed away at the age of 59. Mr. Smith went to his grave never knowing who murdered Judy or why. The mystery remained with him to his final days. Judy's two children, Craig and Amy, have never received answers to any of the questions revolving around this mysterious and disturbing case. How is it possible that all these years later, still, no one has the answers as to what drew Judy to the mountains and who saw the kind, caring, and loving young mother, wife, and nurse as an easy target for murder? One thing, though, is certain. Someone knows the answers to these questions. Someone knows exactly what happened to Judy, and there's a chance that person is still somewhere in Western North Carolina. This didn't appear to be a completely random crime. There was no motive determined. Robbery obviously wasn't the reason, for which many suggest that the killer committed this crime purely out of a desire to do so. If that is the case, there are likely more bodies buried in the national forests of Western North Carolina, or perhaps even more widely around the country, and the person responsible could still be out there, plying their craft and destroying more families. Hopefully, for the family of Judy Smith, the answers will be found sooner than later. I've tried a lot of different deodorants, and Native is the only one that works. Native deodorant is amazing and filled with natural ingredients such as coconut oil and shea butter. People love Native, and they've received over 8,000 five-star reviews from their customers. You can hear all about Native on the Today Show, in Elle Magazine, Pop Sugar, and Refinery 29, to name a few. Less is more with Native. They have fewer, simpler ingredients, so you know everything that's in their deodorant. Aluminum may be linked to some serious health ramifications, but Native is aluminum-free, safe, and effective. With Native, there's something for everyone, with a wide variety of enticing scents for men and women. Plus, they release new limited edition seasonal scents throughout the year. They even offer an unscented formula that is baking soda free for those with sensitivities. Personally, I love the cucumber and mint scent, though coconut and vanilla, the most popular scent, is right up there. I feel safe using a deodorant where I know what it's made of, and I don't have to worry about a bunch of potentially unhealthy ingredients. For 20% off your first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com and use the promo code TRACE. That's nativedeodorant.com with the promo code TRACE for 20% off your first order today. How many of you have pets? I've always been a dog person myself, but I love animals of all kinds. That's why, when it comes to taking care of my dog, I trust Solid Gold. Solid Gold was the first holistic pet food company in America, started in 1974 by Sissy McGill. Sissy was a trailblazer and a pioneer who disrupted a male-dominated industry and created a natural pet food before it was cool. Solid Gold's nutritional platform is inspired by their beliefs that high-quality food is the best way to impact our pet's mind, body, and spirit. Solid Gold foods cleanse the digestive system with whole superfoods, balance it with living probiotics, and fuel your pet with omega-3 and 6 fatty acids, supporting gut health and nourishing your pet inside and out. Right now, Solid Gold is offering my listeners 30% off your first order by visiting solidgoldpet.com/trace. That's solidgoldpet.com/trace for 30% off your first order. Remember, solidgoldpet.com/trace to save 30% today. The murder of Judy Smith is one of those cases that once you dig into it, you want to keep digging, but the more you dig, the less you find. Judy Smith was murdered over 20 years ago, and almost nothing new has come to the surface in those 20 years. Most information you can find is a repetition of what is known, with little, if any, new information presented. I happen to live in the area. I've been to Pisgah Forest, I frequent Asheville, and even my contact in the Buncombe County Sheriff's Office wasn't able to provide me with much information beyond what I'd already found. Investigators are still pretty tight-lipped about this case, and whether that's due to not knowing much or not wanting to reveal too much depends on who you ask. I was told in an indirect way that if there was more information to share about this case, it would have been shared by now. Unlike many of the cases I cover here, this one is sort of a dual mystery. We know basically how Judy's life ended, though we don't know who wielded the blade. However, we also don't know what brought Judy to this area in the first place. No connections have ever been established, and while the Asheville area is a popular tourist location, that's mostly developed a lot in the past 20 years. Prior to that, it was sort of a hidden gem of a city tucked into the Blue Ridge Mountains. That isn't to say Judy didn't know of the area or have an interest in visiting it. She just never mentioned that to anyone in her life, as far as we know. I suppose the true mystery about Judy's trip isn't so much that she took it, but the manner in which she took it. It would be one thing if Judy had written a note saying where she was headed, left home, and then placed a few calls to let her family know she was all right, but that didn't happen here. Instead, Judy went on a trip to Philadelphia with her husband, went out on a tour of the city, and seemingly with little consideration, began her trek down to western North Carolina. She left behind the luggage she'd brought with her to Philadelphia, as far as we know, and had only her backpack with her, though the contents of that backpack can't be known. For some people, the speed with which she left indicates that something must have happened to make her want to leave. While friends and family argued that Judy and Jeffrey were happy, at least one of Judy's friends disagreed, and it was her belief that Judy left to take a break. That, in conjunction with the Philadelphia Police Department's initial theories, have led many to wonder how much information Jeffrey Smith may have had that he didn't share with investigators, and that leads us to our first theory. The theory that Jeffrey Smith was somehow involved in Judy's murder isn't exactly a new one. It's been there since almost day one, but it's to be expected. While it was originally investigated as a missing persons case, investigators almost always look at the spouse first. It just makes sense, logically and statistically. However, in the case of Jeffrey Smith, there really wasn't much to support the theory, if there was anything at all. And I'm discussing this theory less so because of its plausibility and more so to try and clear the air and show why this theory doesn't make much sense. Firstly, you've got the split between Philly, Boston, and Asheville. Some believed early on that Judy may have vanished prior to arriving in Philadelphia and that the entire missing persons report was a cover-up. While I understand that line of thought, it doesn't take much work to begin poking holes in it. We know that Jeffrey flew to Philadelphia alone, which makes some believe that the whole idea of Judy forgetting her license was to explain why they weren't on the flight together. That makes sense, until you realize that multiple witnesses at the hotel and in the Philadelphia area confirmed that Judy did in fact arrive at the hotel. That seems to rule out the idea that something happened to her before the trip. Beyond that, we know Judy flew from Boston to Philadelphia and brought luggage with her, so if nothing else, we pretty much know Judy did arrive in Philadelphia. Once you've established that fact, the idea of Jeffrey having been directly involved in the murder makes very little sense. His timeline is well established. He was in contact with police, colleagues, and members of hotel staff during the week. It would have been extremely difficult for him to have found a window of opportunity to travel 600 miles, commit a murder, and return without ever being noticed missing. The only time this could possibly have happened would have been the very first night, since Jeffrey first mentioned to someone that his wife was missing around 6 p.m. the next day. That leaves less than a 24-hour window for Jeffrey to have committed the crime. There are three DoubleTree hotels in the Philadelphia area. The DoubleTree at the airport is the most southern one, being located at 4509 Island Avenue, and it's located 526 miles from Pisgah National Forest and 600 miles from Asheville. This is between an 8 and a 9.5 hour drive, meaning that had Jeffrey taken Judy from the hotel at 7 p.m., he wouldn't have arrived in the area until after 3 a.m., at the earliest. He then would have to commit the crime, get into the difficult terrain, bury Judy, and then make it back to Philadelphia by the time he was seen at breakfast the next morning. The earliest he could have gotten back under this timeline would have been 11 a.m., well after the conference had already begun for the day. It's also important to note that since they were staying in the hotel where the conference took place, Jeffrey would have needed a vehicle, and there's no record that he rented one. Those details alone seem to show that Jeffrey could not have committed the murder. However, some have argued that he may have hired a professional to commit the crime for him. For this to be the case, several things must be true that have never been established. Firstly, Jeffrey would have had to have paid the hitman, and there's no strange behaviors on his banking account showing a large cash withdrawal. Beyond that, he'd either have to have hired this person to take Judy from Philadelphia, or he'd have to have known she was going to Asheville. Some have argued that Judy may have told Jeffrey of her trip, and he lied about this as a way to cover up the crime. But again, nothing's ever been established to show that. Ultimately, what you have to ask yourself is why Jeffrey would have done this in the first place. Some believe that a divorce may have been imminent and Jeffrey wanted a cheaper solution, but there's really no proving that hiring a hitman would have been cheaper. Not to mention, both Judy and Jeffrey had been divorced before, and there's absolutely no record or history of Jeffrey ever being violent or threatening violence against Judy, nor his first wife. This would have had to have come out of nowhere. But Jeffrey would have had to have planned it in advance. The more you look at it, the less sense it all makes. Now, there's no accounting for the level of skill someone might find in a professional hitman, but most people don't believe the hitman would have left any evidence behind, such as the sunglasses and backpack. Not to mention, most hitmen operate with firearms, not bladed weapons. Now, I can't say with 100% certainty that this isn't what happened. But when you weigh everything out, it does seem far-fetched. You've got to consider that Jeffrey reported his wife missing, despite the Philadelphia police being disinterested. He spoke to prominent politicians to get the wheels moving, participated in interviews, pushed for more attention, and was very driven in trying to locate her. This could be an elaborate cover-up, but it seems counterproductive for Jeffrey to do all of this, if indeed he was involved. Some have suggested his choice not to take the polygraph may be a sign of potential guilt, but as I've said on this show a million times, they're not reliable. The man was a lawyer and knew that, and frankly, I wouldn't take a polygraph about a stolen bag of potato chips, let alone a murder. From everything I could find, Jeffrey Smith was a hardworking, caring, law-abiding citizen who never committed any crimes and who loved his wife. It's a sad thing that people still look at him as a potential suspect, but I suppose when you're dealing with a murdered spouse, it only makes sense. However, amongst everything we know, if Jeffrey Smith was still a suspect, which according to the police, he is not, he would be a very poor suspect in this case. So if it wasn't Jeffrey Smith, who could it have been? Unfortunately, there are some names that are connected to similar crimes. So I went through the crimes of Gary Michael Hilton, Lewis Kyle Wilson, and Richard Allen Jackson, three men who were known to have committed murders in the area and to have utilized either national forest land or secluded remote locations for the disposal of their victims. Jackson is ruled out immediately. He was in prison and on trial during the time that Judy was murdered. Hilton's known crimes began taking place between 2005 and 2008, meaning that it's unknown if he was actively committing murders in the late 1990s. However, he did have a propensity for decapitating victims, which didn't happen here. That doesn't necessarily rule Hilton out, as Judy was murdered by a bladed weapon, and obviously Hilton would have had one in his possession. Hilton is an interesting study, as we know, at least in the instance of the Bryants, that he'd been camping in the area and scouting for potential victims. His crimes seemed to be those of opportunity, targeting individuals who had entered onto hiking trails in national parks where he himself would already have been. Once he saw the chance to commit his crimes, he struck, and this could have happened in Judy's case had she entered Pisgah National Forest of her own volition. I do think it's interesting to note that at the time of Judy's murder, Hilton was 50 years old and that he and Judy were only 1 month apart in age. His first confirmed victim was killed in 2006 when he would have been 59, which seems like a late age for a killer to begin. Hilton had been considered a suspect in several other murders, but the earliest took place in 2005 when he was 58. So I think there's a good likelihood that Hilton was active prior to his 50s, but we don't have anything to prove that. No evidence has ever been found to link Hilton to Judy's murder other than the fact that he was active in the area and committed similar crimes. Unfortunately, due to a lack of evidence, there will likely never be a connection made between Hilton and Judy if indeed he committed the crime. One detail, though, which makes things a little different to some degree, is that Hilton typically left his victims exposed. He didn't go out of his way to try and bury anyone or conceal remains, which is a little different from what happened to Judy. So while no connections can be officially made, many believe that Hilton could have been responsible. I tried to narrow down a timeline of where Hilton was in the late 1990s, but the man functioned as a drifter, and it's almost impossible to know. So what about Lewis Kyle Wilson? Wilson's victims were primarily sex workers whom he spent time around as he functioned in the drug world dealing various types of illegal substances. We know that Wilson abducted, assaulted, and stabbed a victim, though she survived and was able to identify him. Part of his crime involved taking the woman back to his home. Several other sex workers reported being picked up by a man fitting Wilson's description, at which time they were taken to locations within 100 feet of his home to be assaulted. In the case of Kelly Lane Smith, for whom Wilson is a suspect but has never been charged, she was also a sex worker who was murdered and dismembered, having her body parts scattered in two separate locations within close proximity to Wilson's home. Both of his crimes revolve around his home, and for some, they wonder if it's possible that he could have encountered Judy, mistaken her for a sex worker or maybe a transient, and tried to get her to come home with him, at which time things could have turned violent. We know in the case of his first victim, Wilson knocked her unconscious to take her home. That could have happened here as well. So we know Wilson used a knife, and we know he stabbed at least one person. If he was involved in Kelly Lane Smith's murder, then this would show that he also used that weapon to dismember at least one victim. However, as with Hilton, Wilson's crimes took place in the 2000s, specifically 2008 and possibly 2006. This again pads a decade between his crimes and the murder of Judy Smith. Lewis Kyle Wilson was 31 in 2008, meaning that he was born in 1977, which would make him only 20 years old at the time of Judy Smith's murder. That's not an impossibility by any stretch of the imagination, though. However, Wilson's MO is a little different. He mostly went to areas he knew sex workers would be, picked them up, and then drove them to locations near his home where he would commit his crimes. In most instances, he assaulted the women and threatened to kill them, but didn't. In one confirmed attempt to murder a victim, he failed. These don't exactly seem like the behaviors of a man who has successfully committed murders from the age of 20 years old, but again, anything is possible. If he was involved in Kelly Lane Smith's murder, then he has shown the ability to commit the crime, cover it up well enough to avoid direct charges, and to have utilized a knife to do it. It's a little weird for me that one of the murders, Kelly Lane Smith, that they try to link to Wilson also involves a woman with the last name of Smith. However, when we're looking at this specific case, we have to remember this. Wilson lived in a cheap place, dealt drugs, and drove a junky truck. You'd imagine, had he murdered Judy, he'd likely have taken her cash and possibly her ring, but that didn't happen here. Robbery isn't believed to be connected. There's also the man who sexually assaulted the 64-year-old woman and left her tied to a tree. While this is obviously a sick and disturbed individual, police don't believe the crimes are connected, as this person specifically targeted the victim for sexual assault and no murder took place, instead leaving her bound to a tree. However, there is the possibility that Judy could have come upon this man and maybe fought back, which could have resulted in him going beyond his limits and committing the murder. Maybe that would explain wrapping the body. Purely speculative on my part, but you never know. Of course, that sexual assault took place in 2016, 19 years after Judy was murdered. There is, of course, the possibility that maybe it is the same man, but 19 years had passed and he didn't feel as confident in his abilities to get away with murder. So, we've got a list of people here who could potentially have been involved, but not enough to connect any of them to the actual crime. It's understandable why this murder remains such a mystery. However, if it wasn't Judy's husband, and maybe it wasn't one of these killers, then who else could it have been? Some have speculated that Judy either knew someone in the area, or she met someone along the way to Asheville. While this is a vastly dark area in which we have little to no information, it is one to be explored here in our final theory. Before moving directly into the final theory, I did want to address one aspect of the case that's always bothered me. Police argued that the murder had likely taken place at the scene where Judy's remains were recovered because it would have been difficult for someone to pull her remains up there after the murder had taken place. However, Judy suffered from severe arthritis in her left knee, which has always made me wonder why she'd have agreed to ascend into that area in the first place. Now, maybe she was forced to at knife point, but it wouldn't have been that easy of a trek for her regardless. I do believe there's a possibility she could have been killed elsewhere and then transported to the location. Generally, people seem to be living under the assumption that this crime was committed by one person. But if more than one person was involved, then I think the idea that it would have been too difficult to bring her up to that spot post-mortem becomes a bit moot. So, we don't know how Judy got to North Carolina. No records of travel were ever found, though if she bought a ticket with cash, it was 1997. I don't know that travel requirements were as stringent then as to require a photo ID. She could have purchased a ticket using a fake name, I suppose. There's also the information that she couldn't take the first flight with Jeffrey because she had left her ID at home. As someone who had traveled frequently, some have pointed out that this was an unusual mistake for her to make, but it does happen. However, there are those who believe that not taking the flight with Jeffrey was done on purpose while she finalized some kind of travel plans to leave Philadelphia for North Carolina, which could have involved another person. As far as we know, Judy didn't know anyone in the area of Western North Carolina, but it's a popular retirement location, so I don't think we can completely rule out the possibility that she once knew someone who later moved down to this area. While the family doesn't believe there's any connection there, we also have to consider that no one believes she'd have gone down to North Carolina by herself without telling anyone in advance either. If indeed it was all about taking a break from her marriage, and maybe from everything, then what better place to go than one where you can be anonymous? That's a little contradicted, though, when you remember that Judy specifically told at least one person in Asheville that she was married to a lawyer and lived in Boston. I guess the aspect I've never been able to wrap my head around was the idea that Judy would have gone to North Carolina without telling anyone in the first place. If it wasn't pre-planned, why not tell someone? Why not tell your husband that rather than attending the conference while he's in Philadelphia, you're going to North Carolina and you can meet in Jersey on the way back to see friends? I could talk myself in circles about this particular aspect of the case, but I'm not going to get anywhere close to an answer, and even if I did, I can't verify that answer. So unfortunately, we kind of just have to accept that Judy ended up in the Asheville area, whether it was by catching a ride with someone she knew, taking mass transportation that wasn't noticed, or maybe even catching a ride with a stranger. Once she's down in this area, everything becomes a mystery. We've got two witnesses placing her in a gray sedan. That gray sedan has never been found or linked to anyone. While we can't verify those witness statements completely, it's a bit beyond the pale to imagine that two people reported a very similar sighting in a similar area without knowledge of each other's statements, as far as we know. Who this car belongs to, where it came from, you can just add that to the list of details about this case that we simply don't have answers for. Judy didn't appear to be hiding. It's not like she was giving a fake name to people and avoiding people. She was described as polite, seeming to have her life together, and just a typical tourist. We know now that she was anything but typical at the time, but she didn't seem to express any concern about anyone seeing her there. She wasn't going out of her way to avoid being noticed. As far as we know, to Judy, this was a normal trip down south, or at least that's how she presented it. It's not like she told people that she had come down to Asheville without telling anyone, and for reasons we may never understand, that's exactly what she did. She'd have to know Jeffrey would notice her missing, but she left nothing behind to explain her absence. She even left her luggage behind, which has made some people believe her decision was more a spur of the moment, perhaps as a friend suggested, that something happened and she needed a break. By whatever way Judy ends up in Western North Carolina, at some point, someone makes the decision to stab her. The definite cause of death has never been stated because there wasn't enough evidence to know for certain. It's known that she was stabbed, but whether those stabs caused her death or took place after her death is unknown. If indeed the sightings are true and Judy was driving a gray sedan, it seems to me there's a high likelihood that she knew someone in the area and maybe that vehicle belonged to that person. She bought $30 worth of food and a toy truck. Seems like a weird purchase for a woman who's missing, whether or not she knew that she was missing. Another important detail is that when Judy's remains were found, the medical examiner initially determined based on decomposition that she'd been in that spot for between a year to 2 years. But we know now that she'd only been missing for 5 months when she was found. Seems strange that her remains skeletonized so quickly, but without more forensic evidence, there's not much of a way to determine whether or not something was used to speed up that process. Just another question without an answer. So what do we know? We know that Judy Smith came down to Western North Carolina, was murdered, and whoever committed the crime has never been found. Whether this was someone she knew and trusted, someone she met along the way, or someone who just happened to be in the area and looking for a victim, we don't know. To me, based on the scene of the crime, items left behind, Judy's missing backpack and wallet, the lack of a robbery, the witness reports of the car, and the very remote location in which she was found, I don't really doubt that this person was familiar with this area and likely someone living within 50 miles of Pisgah Forest. The fact that no money was taken, but Judy's wallet, including her ID, was, and her red backpack was never recovered, makes me want to believe that the killer probably knew her and was trying to conceal her identity to distance himself from the crime, but again, on my part, that's purely speculative. Judy Smith was a hard-working, kind woman who loved her children and her husband. For the 50-year-old nurse, if there's any word that can be used to describe her in almost all aspects of her life, it was dependable. If Judy said she was going to be there, she'd be there. She fought hard to raise her children while working to put herself through school. She rose up quickly through her profession and was praised by her clients and their families. I mean, that's how she met her husband. So what can happen to take someone like Judy Smith, cause her to vanish, and then months later be found 600 miles away, the victim of a homicide? Unfortunately, we don't have that answer. In the 22 years since Judy Smith was murdered, her name is still spoken in Western North Carolina. I originally learned about her case within months of moving to the area. It's always bothered me to walk the streets of Asheville that she walked, to enter Pisgah Forest knowing what happened there, but not the how or the why. Perhaps most bothersome of all is the knowledge that her husband passed away never knowing the truth, and her children to this day have only memories of their mother rather than her company in their homes. A family was destroyed, and now they're haunted by the possibilities. To this day, Western North Carolina remains haunted by the unsolved case, and investigators acknowledge that the likelihood of finding answers gets slimmer each year. Hopefully, sooner than later, we'll get more information. Something will be found, some connection will be made. Until then, the murder of Judy Smith remains open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the murder of Judy Smith, there are some articles and websites that discuss her case, though not a great deal of them. Unsolved Mysteries ran a segment on her story, which you can still watch on YouTube. And as always, I'll link to all articles and sources used for this episode in both the show notes and on the website. If you have any information about the murder of Judy Smith, please contact the Buncombe County Sheriff's Office at 828-250-4503. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, Instagram message me at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. What app are you using to listen to podcasts? I've been using the Himalaya app, and I really love the setup. It's so much easier and streamlined than many others. But there's an added bonus with Himalaya. Through the app, you can become a supporter of Trace Evidence. Without even having to leave the app, you can sign up for a small monthly fee that goes directly to production costs for the show. And in return, you'll receive ad-free episodes and access to upcoming monthly bonus premium episodes. If you'd like to test this out, visit Himalaya.com/Trace Evidence and use the promo code Evidence for 1 month free. Once you get used to ad-free episodes and bonus content, you won't want to turn back. As some of you are aware, on Patreon, I will begin posting one episode per month that is not available in the normal feed beginning in September. In these episodes, I'll discuss a variety of cases, including solved cases, which are voted on monthly by patrons. These episodes will also be available through the Himalaya podcast app for those who become premium members. But speaking of Patreon, it's time for a shout out to our amazing Patreon producers. Angie Dodd, Emily Smith, Megan Cotter, Kate Alexander, Chandra Moreau, Robbie Blue, Brian Kemmerling, Wannabe Sleuth 2, Laura Dickinson, Julia Rexon, Diane Dyson, Tom Archer, Eamon Brady, Nick Mohar Schurz, Alicia Lorraine, Jessica, Krista Colvin, Randy Wyland, Brittany Bivens, Glenda Piper, and Megan. You're all amazing, and if you're new and I mispronounced your name, just shoot me a message and I'll correct it. As we enter the month of October, I usually approach cases a little bit differently, where I try to focus more on cases that I'm personally invested in, ones that bother and disturb me, whether or not there's a great deal of information available, as you've seen in today's episode. But that being said, hopefully the month of October will be full of cases that you'll find as interesting as I do. So I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.